You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
Good evening and welcome to The Lyric Feature. The Illan pipes are a complex-looking instrument at the best of times, and at their very heart, often unnoticed, are its reeds, without which they make no music. But the reeds themselves are fickle creatures, singing like larks one day and unaccountably silent the next. It's a fate that pipers Paddy Benson and Grace Lemon know all too well. And on this week's Lyric Feature, they explore it in the company of pipe makers and fellow pipers. This is Dead Reeds.
Pipers and pipe makers are very much at the mercy of their reeds. One day, a reed might sing and buzz. The next, it could suffer ill fate, be tossed in the bin or retired, placed on a shelf to gather dust. Sudden failure or gradual withering will at some point catch them out, or so it seems. Reeds are precarious creatures, and in acknowledging their fragility, we begin to encounter stories of life and death.
In writing their obituaries, we retrace their life cycles. From their birth as cane to their uncertain existence in the hands of harvesters, makers and players. It takes us on a journey rooted in place and community. From London to Dublin, Armagh, Catalonia, back to Dublin, Yorkshire, Vermont, California and onwards, unearthing a score of voices.
I'm Mick O'Brien.
My name is Moira Nichrada.
I'm Killian Valerie.
I'm Sam Lawrence.
This is my uncle, Carlos Medir, and I am Irene Medir.
Benedict Kohler.
Ed Anderson.
My name is Eamon Corn.
I'm Carl Rome.
Dave Hagerty.
My name is Bill Hannon.
Paddy Benson.
And Grace Lemon. The Illan pipes are Ireland's traditional bagpipes. Illan means elbow in Irish. They're different from the well-known Highland pipes in that they're bellow-operated, not blown by mouth. This is how they're played.
Step one, attaching the bellows.
One arm slips through the strap of the bellow, held between elbow and body, tied to the waist with a second belt, then joined to the bag by a flexible tube and sealed stock.
Step two, filling the bag with air.
The bellow arm pumps and a valve opens. Air is drawn in as the bellows expand, then closes as they compress. The other arm and elbow press against the bag as it fills with air.
Step three, sounding the chanter.
The chanter slots into the neck of the bag and stands on the player's thigh. With a small reed inside the chanter's cap, air flows from the bag so it vibrates and sounds.
Step four, holding pressure.
Controlling airflow is a delicate balance, pumping with one arm and squeezing with the other, like steady breathing. Too much pressure and the reed will squawk. Too little and it won't sound at all.
Step five, playing the chanter.
Held with both hands, one above the other, the chanter is where the melody is played. Ornaments, cuts, taps, rolls and crowns give detail and phrasing.
Step six, turning on and tuning the drones.
The pipes have three drones, bass, baritone and tenor. Each sounding the same note, an octave apart. They rest on the player's leg and sustain a low hum beneath the melody. Gradual adjustments, sliding each drone towards or away from the bag, bring them in tune by listening for their warble to fade.
Step seven, using the regulators.
The regulators sit above the drones, three keyed rows, again, bass, baritone and tenor, that are played with the wrist. They provide simple chords and rhythmic accompaniment.
Step eight, listening.
The chanter, regulators and drones sound together, seven reeds in total. It's a full and blended sound. It can be bright or mellow, rich yet also clear and resonant. Reeds have unique characteristics. Handcrafted from organic material, there is so much scope for subtle variation. When Paddy and I started writing music together, this naturally became our starting point. We began experimenting with how our reeds pair together and found that certain combination of notes give a distinct buzz. This echoed an installation at London's Kew Gardens we had visited around the same time. It was a giant hive with an ambient soundscape of 40,000 bumblebees humming and conversing, a wonderful drone symphony.
As we continued to write together, we were guided by our reeds and their particular idiosyncrasies. At the same time, we became conscious of our attachment to and dependency on them. We became attuned to their precariousness and fragility, which led us to consider their stories, to explore the reed as a cultural and historical artifact outside of its chanter, the lives of dead reeds.
When you said it first, you're thinking, God Almighty, what would you talk about? Like, what are they even looking for? I was thinking, and then when I thought about it more, I think, yeah, well, actually, you know, there's so much there that has actually happened with because of the reeds, you know. They're all little stories, yeah.
That was Mick O'Brien, who we first spoke to on Zoom, workshopping the project as it was getting off the ground. As a prolific musician and teacher, we knew he'd have a wealth of insights to share.
We've got a few questions to kick off. Are you happy to start just by explaining how you arrived at playing the Illan pipes?
My father was interested in music, and he used to go into the Piper's Club in Thomas Street. This was back in 1970. And at the time, they were just trying to encourage youngsters to play the pipes. So what they did was that they had a pipes on loan scheme. So you'd go in. My father was in, obviously, at the session. He used to go in every Saturday night for the session. And one of the characters in there could have been Jim Toohey. It could have been Leon Rowson. It could have been anybody. But they said, you know, to think, you have a few children at home. Is that right? Yeah, sure. There's a bag and bellows and chanter to take them home with you. Like, see what would happen, you know? So I had a brother, Tom, and he was 7. I was 9. And of course, when you have the bellows, the bag and the chanter, it's all a little bit, you know, a bit much maybe for a young child. So I tried them and I could manage to get some kind of sound out of them. So Daddy said, great, you take the pipes, I'll get Tom a fiddle. So that's really all the thought that went into me actually playing the pipes. And ever since, it's been torture. And like, I'd be playing at home and Daddy'd say, oh, you know, I think that chanter's out of tune. Now, I didn't understand anything about reeds at the time. Like, I know now if I start playing today on these pipes, I know that they're going to be like 5 to 10 cent flat. And when I play them for 10 minutes, they're going to be sharp. They're going to come up into concert pitch. I didn't know that at the time. And my father certainly didn't know. I didn't know anything about how the pipes even are tuned, you know. So you go around to Leon and Leon had fixed the reed and I go back. And a couple of days later, the same thing again. You walk around to Leon and walk home. Yeah, Leon says it's fine. And then the same thing. It just continued on like this, you know.
We visited Mick in November 2024 at his home and workshop in Raheny, a northern suburb of Dublin.
And then so you have chanter reeds, regulator reeds.
There he showed us 3 dead reeds that meant a great deal to him, attributing them to their makers. These are my 3 reeds, he said, Dan, Alan, and Louis.
So they'll be my 3 reeds, Dan, Alan, Louis.
The first reed Mick showed us was what he called Dan's reed. Dan Dowd was Mick's father's friend and was one of the most important reed makers in Dublin in the 70s and 80s. This was at a time when there was a growing concern that the pipes would become extinct. Pipe making in particular was considered a dark art and makers were few and far between. Mick spent more and more time with Dan, and it was in his workshop that he first saw reeds come to life.
During the summers, I'd walk down, 15 minutes down to Dan, so he'd be there with him all day, and he'd go out to the shed. Like, Dan was retired, so he wasn't, like, in the shed making pipes or reeds every day of the week, but he'd be out in the back and maybe cutting out leather for bags, or someone would come, oh, this fella's coming out for a reed, we'll have to fix his reed up, and you'd be there watching Dan doing, fixing up these reeds, and he'd be smoking away the cigarette and the ash would be falling down and he'd put that out and he'd get the reeds going, and like, it could be anyone coming in, you know, with pipes or whatever to be fixed up.
Dan Dowd and his wife May went over to America in the 1970s, where they visited an avid pipe collector called Tom Busby, who had moved over from Fermanagh. When they met Tom, they told him they were looking for a set for a young boy at home. Tom said he had the perfect set for Mick, made by the renowned Willie Rowsome in 1921.
Tom had bought the set for $25 from a pawn shop on Fifth Avenue in 1923.
And so Dan came home and he rang up the house. Oh, I'm after getting a set of pipes for Mick. Great. So I was expecting something like this, sitting on the table, like, shining. So he came up with a plastic bag full of bits. And I looked. I'm sure my jaw dropped to the ground. Oh, we get them going, said Dan. And I said, oh, OK, great. So we did.
When they showed up in this bag and your jaw dropped, were there any reeds in it? Presumably
No reeds.
And so what was that process like?
Dan had a box of reeds, like the boxes of reeds, like here. And he said, oh, I'll try this one. No, that doesn't work. I'll try that one. Oh, that's OK. That'll do.
As we speak, the reed Dan selected is in Mick's hands. It's small, with a loose bridle, a rubber band fastened around its base and blue tack at the bottom to keep it fixed in the chanter. Short and stumpy and full of smoke from years of Mick playing it in the pubs, it barely looks like a reed at all.
On that reed from Dan, aside from how it sounds, if you had to kind of summarise, why is it important to you? What do you think?
Well, why it's important to me is because it was the only reed I had. So if you wanted to play, then you've only one choice. You have to look after that reed.
The second reed Mick showed us was from the late maker Alain Fremont, who we met through a growing community of pipers directed by word of mouth.
So I was playing then in 87. I was asked to do a part of the Brendan Voyage in Brittany, in the Pan-Celtic. And so then I needed to get the pipes going really well. So I said to Tommy Keane in Milltown, on the Sunday, I said, Tommy, I just need a reed for this chant. I need to get them going well. And he said, you just need to go to Alain Fremont. I said, oh, I never even heard of Alain Fremont at this stage.
Alain was a Breton man who had worked and travelled all over the world, both as an engineer and as a cornet player. As Mick recalls, his musical ear and technical knowledge made for a meticulous pipe maker.
So I went down the following week. I rang Alain. Yeah, no problem, Mick. He knew who I was. Come on down. And so on the Saturday then, I went down to Alain and he made the second reed, which was possibly, that is, the nicest reed I ever had working in this chanter, right? He learned from Finbar Fury, right? So it's much bigger head, different, completely different type reed, you can see, right? He made this reed on a Saturday afternoon. And I'd say he had the reed made in a half an hour. It was really quick. Fitted into the chanter. Wow, that's great. It's just beautiful. He says, hold on, maybe. Maybe it's not quite right. Try it again. And he scraped a little bit. He says, And then he started taking it apart. Now, before, like, if you got a reed going at all, anywhere close, you just left it and didn't touch it. So then Alain finished the reed. I put it in the chanter and I played it and I thought, oh, Alain, this is fantastic. He said, hold on, I think maybe the second octave might be a bit sharp. So he proceeded to take the reed apart. And then, of course, I'm thinking, don't touch the reed because it's the best reed I've ever had and you're taking it apart, thinking like, well, if you're going to take it apart, it's never going to be the same. Move the reed out a little, put it back in. And like, to my surprise, it played really, really well. It was just amazing.
Mick played that reed for about 12 years, including for the recording of May Morning Dew. From that Saturday on, the pair became like brothers, ringing every other week and sharing family holidays. It was from Alain that Mick learnt the art of reed making. He applies his design and measurements to this day. Alain sadly passed away in 2008, but he very much lives on as Mick proudly holds up the first reed he received from his dear friend in 1987.
Mick's third and final reed came from his friend Louis Prior. Like Alain, Louis is from Brittany and comes from an engineering background.
So he made about maybe 20, 30, 40 reeds as tests, like, you know, just to test, make sure, because that's the type of person he is. It's unbelievable, actually.
And have any of Louis Reed's died on you?
Yes.
They have.
So one. There was one, like, when was it, 2019, 2020, when they opened up the new hall in Milltown, right? And it was so humid, and I was playing last, right? So I played my first set of jigs or whatever, all going grand. And then I played kind of an air into a hop jig or something, and I could just, I could feel the reed just dying. Just literally feel the reed. And you go to the back D, and you can, hold on. No, I'd played the reed maybe for a year or whatever. No, back D. Then everything just kind of collapsed. And I knew then that I had another couple of reeds of Louis inside in the box, like this, actually probably that box. So I knew, okay, just take one of them, just put it into the chanter. I didn't even have to tune the chanter. Go up on stage and just play it. It was perfect.
From what began with Mick saying he wasn't sure he'd have anything to say about dead reeds, ended with, or rather opened, a conversation about friendship, shared knowledge and passions across continents.
We heard how, through Dan, Mick came into his first set of pipes, made by Leo Rousham in 1926, lost and found in New York, and then brought back to Ireland in the 70s. How in Alain, Mick found a lasting friendship, underscored by memories of family summers in France. And with Louis, Mick learned how to optimise reliability in an instrument defined, loved and hated by its unreliability. Prompted by our discussion with Mick, we wanted to gather even more stories. We were encouraged that there would be so much more to collect, potential openings or avenues to explore, offered up by the reeds. The William Kennedy Piping Festival presented a perfect opportunity for further fieldwork. In November 2024, we attended its 30th anniversary.
The festival is a celebration of the life and work of William Kennedy, the 18th century piper, pipe maker and inventor who was born in 1768 near Banbridge. It brings together pipers from different countries and traditions, a unique gathering of pipers from around the world, with young and old performing, playing, learning and reed making together, including the wonderful Illan piper Maura na Gcrada.
Well, at the moment, I have actually got more than one set, but I've only one on the go at the moment, and it's a Benedict Kohler set. But 15 years, I have it about 15 years. I had actually got a reed today from Cuivín O'Farrill. He's just generously, just about half an hour before the concert, he opened a box of reeds and he gave me a Benedict Kohler reed. I'd already got one, a lovely one too, last week from Mickey Dunn. So I was spoiled for choice. At the moment, I'm spoiled for choice. But yeah, it hasn't always been the case. Like when I was growing up, I started the first set of pipes I had was a Kennedy. Kennedys of Cork. Now they were almost a mythical figure who lived not very far away. But we thought I was always kind of scared of him. I'd heard so much about him. But I was living too long with the flat back tea, and I persuaded my father to bring me up to meet Mossy. He just looked at me, and what was wrong with his reed? What was wrong with his chanter? So I was wondering if you would take just a tiny little bit off the top of the reed. I know that'll bring up the back tea. I was very nervous saying it to him. He didn't look a bit pleased either. But he took the reed, kind of glaring at me, and chopped it off the top, and I put it back in the chanter. Still wasn't right, so I counted back, and I asked him, would you take another little bit off? And he did. Not very pleased, but rather, well, I must have pushed him, getting more and more terrified. I must have pushed about 15 reeds back and said, you just wouldn't take a little bit off the top of that. Just had slapped his box of reeds closed. He said, there's been enough destruction here for the one night, he said. It never cured it. So that's my reed. It's my earliest reed story. And I had to live with that reed for an awful long time, you know.
Like Mick, Maura initially didn't think she had any dead reed stories. But as she got talking, more tales of disaster, failure and misadventure rose to the surface. Maura went on to tell us about a catastrophic moment in Milltown Malbay's concert hall.
I left the pipes down and I went out for a walk, and I should have noticed as I put the pipes down, tiny, tiny movement. I should have noticed it. I put the pipes down on all those plastic chairs, you know? And that tiny movement was the beginning of a slide, which happened after I left the room and I came back and the pipes were on the floor and the reed sounded like, what is it, an atterjack toad or something like that? Like, it sounded like it was awful. The reed was destroyed. It's a really good reed, Benedict's reed. Gabe McKeown was looking at it, and he said, just in case you're thinking anything, he says, you still have to play. I said, I can't play. And it was extraordinary, really, because every single piper who was down for playing, everyone gave me their chanter. Every single person said, play my chanter. But in fact, Brian McNamara, he was the only one that really worked. It was the only time I hadn't, when I finally got on stage, I hadn't a single nerve left in my body. I just thought, what is this going to sound like? I was as interested as anyone in the audience as to what is going to happen next. So that was, I remember, and at that reed, I was more upset about the reed than I was about the gig, because it has been a perfect reed, and I, as it happened,
we asked Moira what she does with her old and dead reeds, and she gave a lovely description of them, serving almost as a roadmap for future reeds.
I have boxes of reeds, and I have no idea what they are. Anyone would be very welcome to them. I have no use for them, but I wouldn't throw them out. They're working great, and if they're not, I have no great interest in them, you know? I remember Killian O'Brien years ago, and I was so impressed. He would make a reed, and whether it was a glugger or whether it was gorgeous, he would write detailed notes so he'd know what made a bad read, what made a good read, what made a... And he had copiousness. And from that kind of database, then he began to build up. So, maybe watching someone like that, I would feel it be sacrilege to throw them out.
Through Chance Encounter, we learned about another read that defied the odds of death, a read that lingered, lost and found, rehomed, exchanged, recovered. We spoke to a young piper, Cahill Brown, who revealed this unexpected story.
I was rummaging around a second-hand shop near the South Infirmary in County Cork, and I had noticed a lot of bagpipe-related stuff that was there. I noticed among all of these bagpipe reeds, there was this kind of a very kind of a blackened, old-looking... It was a complete reed, but it was unusual because it was an Illan pipe reed among all these bagpipe reeds, and I picked it up, and it had writing on it. The writing said Ford, mid-reg, and I didn't think much of it at the time. I just thought it was interesting. So I brought it home, and I kind of did a bit of research into any Ford Illan pipers in Cork, and I came across an article that John Mitchell had actually written about this connection with Henry Ford, the founder of Ford Motor Cars, and... I found out that his father or his grandfather actually had a set of them, and that he sent the pipes to Cork to be repaired by a local pipe maker, Ty Crowley, in 1926. I went back to the shop and rummaged a bit more, and I found a single blade of a reed. And it had the same Ford, and it was bass, so it was a bass regulator. But on the other side, it had Kenna 1820. So it's confirmed that it was from those pipes, because we did contact the museum that holds the pipes, and we confirmed that they're a Kenna set, a Timothy Kenna set from 1820s, yeah. The first one I got actually crowed, it still worked. So, and I actually put it into the chanter to see if it worked, and it played a scale. Even though it was a regulator reed, it still played a scale, like. So yeah, that's...
And how many years had it been since it was last played, do you think?
I'd say since the 1920s, since Ty Crowley took them in and took them out. He took the original reeds from that set, and he took them out and replaced them. And the reason they were in that second-hand shop is because Crowley's music store, who the Crowley family owned, and Ty Crowley was a part of that. The music store closed down and all of their stuff was sold off to this secondhand shop. And so these bits and pieces were in there among it. And if they weren't saved, they would have been lost forever, like.
From its making in the 1820s, its passage to America, and its return to Ireland in the 1920s, Cathal's Reed spent the best part of a century in a music shop before its transfer to an antique shop. The Reed has journeyed and will journey. It leaves us wondering, in whose hands, if any, will our own Reeds be in 100 years, and will they still crow?
We were also fortunate to catch up with piper Killian Vallely. In our conversation with Killian, we revisited the precarious nature of reeds, their swift and sometimes unforgiving response to the changes in location and environment.
It's funny, you think about it all the time, you know, like if you're going, if summer's really dry or humid or hot or cold, like when you're travelling, you're thinking of the reed, you know. It's a funny thing. If, you know, if you have to store them somewhere where it's cold or really hot, like you're thinking about it. I'm not leaving my pipes there. The reed will be, like last night at the church, I didn't want to leave them in the corridor, you know. It was like I needed to find it a warm place for them. The other thing that's really tough is when you play at altitude. So every 1,000 feet you go up, the reeds deteriorate. And almost to the extent where you would need a different... It's almost like the reed has a different dimension. Or it almost as if your chanter has changed dimensions when you go up. But normally, once you go up around 6 or 7, the reed that works at sea level does not work at all, you know? And I've met classical players and oboes and bassoons out in Colorado and New Mexico and places, and they say they have a different reed for every 1,000 feet.
Killian went on to talk about experimenting with spruce reeds in response to these different kinds of environmental sensitivities.
They've caught on the last few years because they don't react as much to the humidity, dryness factor, and also at the altitude, they don't change as much.
Perfections or imperfections aside, Killian, like most of the pipers we spoke to, has an ever-growing collection.
Do you keep a lot of old reeds?
Yeah. I even have ones from, like, Alan Fremont made. I mean, he's dead now. I've ones with that I know were his. I've ones from Dave Williams, who also died. I've reeds from loads of people. I have a couple of reeds my father had from Frank McFadden, who was a Belfast maker. And we played his pipes when we started. I have a Robbie Hughes reed from way back. So I've got all these reeds from makers that are either gone or I haven't seen them in years, you know. So, and then random strangers give me reeds. They'll go, and I've never played them. Maybe shouldn't say this, but I've never even put them in the chanter. But I have them as that reed that guy gave me, you know. So I have all these things floating around, you know.
We kept returning to the question, why do people hold on to their reeds if they no longer work? Some answers were quite clear-cut. Some people keep them for practical reuse, should they come back to life, whether in their own chanter or somebody else's. While in other instances, they're kept for their associations, memories and attachments. But we were curious about the unspoken reasons for someone keeping a dead reed. The feeling where no obvious memories come to mind, or there's no real likelihood or need for reuse. When people don't quite know why they have so many boxes of them. There was an increasing sense, in listening to these stories, of the reed participating in the fieldwork, and we were being led by the reed itself. And that's how we found ourselves in the wintry sun of a rocky cove, overlooking the Balearic Sea on a Monday afternoon in January 2025.
The conversations we'd been having in Armagh led us to look more closely at our own reeds, curious as to where they came from and what their stories were. We realised how little we knew of their journeys from source to reed and the nature of the material itself. The cane used to make Illanpipe reeds is also known as a Rondo Donax. Grace's was sourced from northern Spain, whereas mine is from California. Earlier sets of pipes would have relied on reeds either made from locally found plants such as elder or imported cane, with international trade, networks and shipping routes well established from the 18th century on. In our search, two names kept cropping up. Ted Anderson, a Californian-based cane harvester, and Madeir, a family-run cane harvesting business in the northeast of Spain near the small town of Palamos.
So this is my uncle, Carlos Madeir, and I am Irene Madeir. We are in Palamos, in Madeir Cane Factory. And my uncle has been taking care of the business for the last 25 years
more.
or more. And I just started, and I will be the fourth Madeir generation to take care of Madeir. It started in 1916.
Yes.
With a Scottish man, no? That was a little bit lost.
Yes.
In 1915, a piper from Scotland who worked in a cork factory in Palamos observed a large quantity of Rondo Donax that grew on the outskirts of the town. At that time, the cane would have been used both in the garden and in construction work. Julio Pachez, a local man who spoke English, began corresponding with the piper and sending over samples of cane to Scotland. Pachez recognised the business potential of cane supply and began to devise a plan, with the support of his brother-in-law, Francisco Madeir, for harvesting cane. With the outbreak of World War I, there weren't many countries supplying cane.
Mainly France was the main country, no, during that, and of course they were in war, so there was no commerce, no one was doing it. And then my grand-granddad saw the opportunity, as Spain was not in war, to start this business.
On approaching the Madeir factory, we noticed the tall, bamboo-like plant growing everywhere. The plant must have been around 6 metres tall, lining roadsides, gardens, streams, rivers and farmland. It was everywhere. Rondo Donax is one of several reed species, a type of grass that typically grows in dense stands and on disturbed sites, sand dunes, along watercourses and wetlands. It's a giant reed with large, upright stems that can exceed 10 metres in favourable conditions. But its diameter is more contained. It doesn't get wider than 3 centimetres throughout its lifetime, unlike bamboo. Can you explain where you find the cane?
So we go and select the cane from different areas around here, because actually here in Costa Brava, Palamos, where we are, it's a perfect actually weather and climate of humidity and heat in the summer. And we don't have a plantation. There is little streams around here, and because cane needs water to grow. So every year we go there and select them so they grow wild, and we don't use any products or anything. They don't belong to anyone, but we have the permissions, of course, to go to these areas and cut them. So we go there and...
It seemed like a mutual exchange between those who consider the material a weed and those who consider it a resource. There is no commercialization of its removal, no expense charged for its collection. Elsewhere, this isn't the case. Harvesters like Ted Anderson report that in California, an eradication program is underway, where cane is recognized as an invasive weed and is being removed by highway departments. Irene and Carlos went on to tell us about how they scope the cane, looking at the diameter and determining the age to inform which instrument or reed it is harvested for, whether it's for drone or chanter reed or for another instrument entirely. The smaller, thinner cane is used for drone reeds, whereas the wider cane is sourced by Madeir for the chanter.
At what point is the right moment of it growing to then collect it?
When it's been called a few weeks, no? When fa fred unas cuantas semanas, then we can start collecting. Because when it's cold, we say that the cane is kind of sleeping.
No? Yes. It's not growing.
It's not growing. With spring, they start growing again, and they start having the branches and everything. So the cane, it's alive again, let's say. So it's best to cut them when they are sleeping. And it's easier than to dry them and all of this.
We were encountering another kind of life cycle, the life cycle of the cane itself. This cycle shapes how it is harvested. Across the Atlantic, Ted Anderson collects cane when the plant has died but is still standing. Standing dead, as it's called. And as the pipe maker Benedict Kohler later explained to us in a letter, So you see, there may be more to the phrase dead reeds than you thought.
Back in Palamos, we ventured out with Irene and Carlos to find some sleeping cane to harvest.
Nascere la primavera.
This one was born in
springtime.
Spring. So the leaves, this one, quan són un any, les perden, no?
Sí.
When it's one year.
El segon any, ara a l'hivern, acostumen a...
When it's 1 year, they lose these leaves.
Sí. They start to shed.
This is good cane for William. No? This is a... It's a very, very long tubes, good diameter. Right.
No? So this is the first step.
We passed the reeds drying in the sun, which were waiting to be turned by hand and yellow in colour, before they're brought inside, peeled, left to dry and cut. We moved through the rooms of Madeir's workshop, which flowed from one to another with piles of cane categorised by instrument, saxophone, clarinet, oboe, bassoon, Ilan pipes, Highland pipes, Galician pipes.
Borolai and Buba, they work with us for how many years? Long, long time. So they know perfectly what they are doing. So if someone asks for sections of cane, then this is a split.
And as they introduced us to the team, with long-standing connections to the Madeirs, it became clear that the harvesting and selection process relies on the transfer of knowledge and the passing of wisdom between generations, much like the tradition of piping, pipe making, and reed making.
So Rock works with us as well, and his dad used to work with us, well, with my uncle for so many years as well, and he does, let's say, a quality control. He does like. He selects for the last step if the tubes are okay with the color, if they are the length, if he checks so many things, and he's so fast.
Reaching the end of the workshop, Irene and Carlos took us into a room filled with a distinctly earthy smell, with boxes of cane, split cane, and different kinds of reeds, all set for distribution.
So these are, for example, all for bassoon, and they are different shapes and different hardness. Mm-hmm. Hardness. Like this one, the shape is Rieger 1A, hard, and this is the same Rieger 1A, but it's medium. So when they play, they know this is softer and this is harder.
Alongside the boxes were piles of magazines and letters. Madeir had been collecting them from the piping community, eager to learn how their reeds were being used. Mirroring their enthusiasm, the pipers and pipe makers we had spoken to had been excited by our visit. The opportunity to ask unanswered questions and see behind the curtain. From our visit to Palamos, we saw firsthand how a reed's natural source material and its harvesting inform the making and character of the reed, from earth to sound. Two reed makers, Eamon Curran and Bill Hanneman, showed us their workings.
Sandpaper or abrasives to scrapers or knives, pieces of broken bottle, nice sharp edge.
This is how a reed is made. Step one, splitting the cane.
The cane is split into four sections, slips, one slip for one reed.
Step two, thinning the reed.
Using a knife, the thickness of the cane is brought down to a point where the edges of the slip become sharp and the flat surface of the slip becomes flexible. Listening to the cane, gradual adjustments and gentle scrapes are made until the feel of the cane is right.
On a flat piece, file them down a sandpaper so they've got a nice even tail both sides. And then I'll take it and turn it round like that, one or two, just to turn them.
Step three, cutting the tails.
The tails of the reed are cut with a chisel to measure the length of a finger knuckle from the end of the slip in, then taken down with sandpaper.
Step four, gouging out the slip.
The slip is gouged and finished with a curved cabinet scraper, working to the feel of the cane and looking for a degree of spring and resistance.
Step five, cutting the slip and tidying the tails.
The slip is cut in half using a blade, leaving two mirrored pieces. Taking a little bit of waxed flax, the two halves are then tied together and beveled.
Step six, tying the reed to the staple.
One end of the staple, a small tube cut from thin copper, soldered and then shaped, is placed between the tails. These are tied with a dental floss-like tape and often cobbler's wax, looped, waxed and wrapped.
tie it up until the sides meet.
The shoulders of the reed are feathered to the tied endpoint, and the staple is moved in incrementally, using the cane to tell you where it wants to close up, and finally retied all the way back down to the other end of the staple.
I tie it on in three stages, just creeping up on it. One, two, and then three.
Step seven, scraping it down, cutting it back, and seeing what it sounds like. Crowing is the first moment a reed maker knows whether or not a reed has legs. Only after its constituent parts have been brought together and tightly bound, only then on sucking on the reed and getting it to sound do we know if it works. The bridle is then fitted to the reed, a small band usually made from copper and used to gently influence the reed's aperture. Step 8. Finishing and testing the reed. The reed is allowed to sit so that the aperture may close down after a few days, settling to the point where it becomes musical. When we first called Bill Hanneman, he was curious about the project's title, Why Dead Reeds? Followed by a long pause. He said that most makers and players are interested in longevity, how long we can keep a reed alive, rather than its endpoint. The death of a reed was not his preoccupation. It sparked an interesting conversation and reiterated that we're most interested in the meanings attached to the reed's lifespans, what they represent beyond their playability, which can often be unending. On visiting Bill in his workshop, we talked about the variability and infinite possibilities presented in reed making, and that it's not just about measurement, but so much about feel. For instance, in knowing when to stop. This echoed another conversation we had with Benedict Kohler, who talked about the importance of listening to the reed. Reed makers, as Benedict put it, need to take guidance from the cane they are working with, because there are a whole trail of signs the reed is showing. It is not a standardized practice, but glorious anarchy. In February, we visited pipe maker Sam Lawrence in the Yorkshire Dales for our final Dead Reeds interview.
It's interesting, Dead Reeds, because, I mean, as you probably know, I have a collection of them. And when you ask me why, I have no idea. It seems to be quite hard. It's a bit like burning a book. It's like, if you've ever burnt a book, I've burnt quite a few. And the first time you burn a book, or the first few times, it feels very wrong. It's really wrong to put it in the fire and watch it burn. And it seems that reeds maybe feel a bit like that, and it's hard to kill them, like to strip them down to their... Not everybody probably thinks that, but to strip them down to their component parts feels a bit wrong.
Why do you think it feels a bit wrong?
Well, it feels like because they've been alive. If you've got a dead reed, then you're suggesting that you've had a living reed. And if you've had a living reed, it feels wrong to start ripping it to shreds.
Sitting in Sam's workshop, talking to him about unendings, his words encapsulated so much for us.
Yeah, well, this is a bit like the thing that people have said about the flight of a bumblebee, that aerodynamically it's not possible for it to fly because it's too... whatever, it's too big and its wings are too small or whatever. And this instrument developed out of double reed instruments like the oboe. And if you play the oboe, you're constantly moving your mouth. They call it the embouchure. So if you want to play this note, you'll have a different mouth shape to these notes. And they can't conceive of how you could play that instrument without doing that. You have to do it. Same with a clarinet and a saxophone, you know, and a bassoon. Whereas the Illan pipes, the reed's in a reed cap and you can't touch it while you're playing. So it's got a fixed embouchure and is expected to do two octaves in tune, and also to function as a closed pipe where you've got it on the knee and you're lifting a finger off to play a note, and an open pipe where you're playing it more like a penny whistle. And that's not really possible. It's, you know, it shouldn't really work, but we've made it work somehow.
Of all the illustrations Sam could have given, it was the bumblebee's return, reminding us of our first steps writing and making music and finding out more about the pipes together. Reeds are precarious creatures. On the one hand, they are fragile. In their delicacy, their smallness, they are open to misadventure. They rely on informal networks of knowledge sharing and on a material susceptible to climate change and government regulation.
And yet, on the other, they are also resilient. They can be found in antique shops decades or centuries after they were made, and still they crow. And where they falter or suffer trauma, the community rallies, lending expertise or spares. They are tiny, but the scale of these things doesn't reflect their capacity to hold meaning and agency. The project was led by their stories. They directed us, and in allowing them to participate, in listening to the reed, our journey gained momentum.
Dead Reeds was written and presented by Paddy Benson and Grace Lemon. Music in the programme was by Paddy Benson, Grace Lemon, Jared Bennett, with harp by Niamh O'Brien. It was recorded, edited and mixed by James Patrick Gavin and Niamh O'Brien and mastered by Sam Proctor at Lismore Mastering. The programme was produced by Niamh O'Brien, Paddy Benson and Grace Lemon, and it was a Niamh O'Brien production for RTE Lyric FM with support from Patricia Baker at Curious Broadcast. And if the piper in your life may have missed that programme, you can tell them they can find it on the Lyric website, on the RTE radio app and other podcast platforms. You can contact the programme by email features.lyricfm@rte.ie.
You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly, and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
That's nearly our lot for The Lyric Feature this evening. John Kelly's Mystery Train is coming up at 7 o'clock. And before that, here's the first movement from Sibelius's Second Symphony, Pohjola's Daughter, and it's played here by the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Colin Davis. On next week's Lyric Feature, we're staying in the world of traditional music when the composer Sean Doherty goes in search of the story behind Chief O'Neill's influential collection of traditional fiddle tunes, the Dance Tunes of Ireland, 1001 Gems. It's a story that follows the contours of O'Neill's own journey from Ireland to the US and deep into the musical life of Irish immigrants in Chicago in the late 19th and early 20th century. 1001 Gems is our Lyric Feature next Sunday at 6 p.m.